From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside SF.
Coming up, African-American sisterhood thrives in a club in Bayview, Hunters Point.
If you, like, always being doubted and not valuing yourself, like, it's just going to keep you from saying anything to anybody instead of standing up for yourself.
Then a local filmmaker shares the story of a gay Korean War veteran tasked with writing dishonorable discharges of outed gay sailors.
Sometimes I am kind of shocked when I read institutionally there is explicit homophobia and transphobia written into the laws of that history.
And we find out the answer to this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound. Striking the right note today on Cross Currents. High up on a hill in Bayview Hunters Point is a tiny bedroom apartment. From the outside, it looks like any other building on the block. But as you approach, sounds of laughing, yelling, stomping, squealing, and music spill out of the door and windows. Gathered inside is a group of black girls, old friends, new friends, cousins, sisters, neighbors. Every day after school, nearly 30 of them make their way here to be part of a makeshift girls-only clubhouse called Girls 2000.
Girls 2000 is excellent, it's good, it's gay because we get to do stuff.
You get to eat dinner here, and when you get home, you don't have to eat any dinner your mom cooks.
Here, the girls can learn to cook for themselves. They help each other with homework. They work on art projects. They talk about boys. And they learn how to grow. Reporter Mwende Hasey has their story.
She is coming at 7? Okay, that's a late room. All right.
A cluster of third and fourth graders take over the living room of the Girls 2000 headquarters after dinner.
Okay, let's start that over. You guys are waiting for me to count. I remember you guys. Everybody's going to count out loud together.
An older girl named Carlina Sherrill teaches them some moves. Step, step, punch, punch, spin in a circle, and high-five your neighbor.
5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3.
If you can edge your way around the little dancers, make your way up the staircase to the computer lab, which is really just a bedroom with a few computers, a love seat, and lots of books. Here is where the big girls congregate.
There are many communities that have denied power in society, that were denied. Come on, Arisha.
Six teenage girls work, or pretend to work, on class assignments. One looks at library books on a computer, another reads a book and texts on her phone. 15-year-old Rainisha Mims works on an essay.
I'm doing an essay about black women, how they've been manipulated, abandoned, sexually assaulted. They can't get jobs because of their race or their sexual gender. So it's just ridiculous, and I think it needs to stop.
Rainisha's being raised by her single mom, which means her mom can't always get to the school and talk to Rainisha's teachers. So if Rainisha needs someone to go to school and advocate for her, girls will be on her side.
It's like very important for you to have that balance and that support.
That support gets reflected in almost everything the girls do here, like the essay Rainisha's writing about black women and oppression.
I have a picture right here of a girl's mouth covered because I was like, black people, like black women in particular, they don't get a chance to speak, and like they're not valued as much as other races are.
Photos of black female leaders adorn the walls of the apartment's living room. Michelle Obama, Harriet Tubman, Angela Davis, Rosa Parks.
I have another picture. It says, oppression can only survive through silence. And I think that is true. If you're like always being doubted and like not valuing yourself, like it's just going to keep you from saying anything to anybody instead of standing up for yourself. That's like with bullying or with, like, you know, different places, you don't have a voice, but I think you have a mouth. You should use it.
Speaking up is encouraged here. Everyone is allowed to be themselves, even though sometimes the girls get a little too comfortable.
I said no selfies. We're going to do no selfie policy.
That's Ashley Blanco.
She's 28 years old and works full-time with Girls 2000.
I don't want them to see themselves as just ratchet or hood or ghetto or whatever.
Ashley is a San Francisco native, raised in the Mission District. On her lapel is a button that reads, "We are the last 3%," outlined with the continent of Africa. 3% is how many African American people she believes still currently populate the city. The last census says those numbers are closer to 6%. Regardless, it's a population in rapid decline. Ashley says she wears the button because she wants folks to know Black people still matter in San Francisco, despite the dwindling numbers. She especially wants the girls to understand.
Really, when I approach them, it's just like, I'm you from the future.
Ashley went to Howard University. For grad school, she studied urban education policy at Brown. But she came back to San Francisco to work with young people because she wanted to make an impact.
Because I am them, you know, and they are me. So I always have that thing, like, you need to do well. And not because you're going to take care of me, but because I don't want to hear you're doing poorly down the line.
Ashley heads to the kitchen to serve dessert. Tonight, they're having banana bread. Ashley and the other adults who run the program do the bulk of the cooking. The girls sometimes chop up fruits and veggies. The food they eat is either donated or grown in their very own garden.
It's got grapevine about to take that.
It's going to take the whole...
It's going to take that fence all the way down to almost the end where the blackberries are at.
The garden is a 20-minute walk from the apartment, way up one of the steepest hills in the Bayview. It's been here for 20 years.
The plan is, Ballet, is we taking all of the greens out of beds and we're transplanting. That's what me and her are doing now. Like, where are we going?
It's 9 a.m., early for a Saturday morning of garden work. The girls trickle into the garden slowly, looking kind of sleepy.
Why do you want to grow that vegetable in the garden this summer? And I hope you know what plants you can grow in the summer in the garden. Ooh, y'all better know.
Okay. That's Brandy Mack. She's the director of Girls 2000. She grew up around farming.
We got three apple trees over there.
Brandy and a group of eight girls gather in a circle by the greenhouse. This is a little ritual they have before getting to work, a way to see how everyone's feeling. Brandy has everyone check in and say what they want to grow this summer.
My name is Imaji and strawberries, because I like strawberries.
My name's Nashe. Is it watermelon?
Yes, you know it, girl.
Watermelon.
We got sugar babies in the greenhouse. Sugar babies.
The sugar babies will be for the girls to sell at the Saturday Alamany Farmers Market, along with other fruits and veggies they grow. But first...
We're going to be transplanting a lot of things today. That's going to be the name of the game. Transplanting and weeding. Because you clearly know our cousin Bermuda grass always creeps up, right?
Someone rolls out a speaker and turns on the radio full blast. The girls spread out amongst the 30 different raised beds and settle into the morning's work. They self-organize into teams. Some transplant mint, some get rid of compost, and others attack that pesky Bermuda grass.
Good job, Isis. Good job. Keep going down the rows.
Brandy likes to use gardening as a metaphor for how Girls 2000 is cultivating the girls' sense of self.
That if you spend too much time with just one thing, you're draining yourself. The idea of getting in there and having different species work together is what allows you to self-reflect.
Self-reflection is somewhat of a luxury when you grow up in the unstable conditions of a neighborhood like Bayview Hunters Point. But it's important, especially for teenagers, to learn to get out of their heads a bit and think about others.
Clearly, that's my underground mission, is to train a whole bunch of women farmers. Take over the world, Pinky. No, but what I do know is they'll have self-sufficiency.
Self-sufficiency, self-reflection, and self-confidence. This group of girls in a San Francisco neighborhood many people consider disadvantaged are rich. Rich with the support of mentors, multiple mother figures, female friends, and opportunities to explore themselves. This group has permanence because of loving cultivation, not just for the garden, but for human culture as well. For Cross Currents, I'm Wanda Hasey.
This story is part of our Sights and Sounds of Bayview project, which shines a spotlight on one of San Francisco's most diverse neighborhoods. Hear more stories like it at KALW's live storytelling event tomorrow at the Joseph Lee Rec Center in San Francisco. It starts at 7 o'clock and it's free. Find more information at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. The 39th annual Frameline Film Festival starts tomorrow in San Francisco, featuring films and shorts about the LGBTQ experience. One short, called The Typist, reaches back about 60 years to tell the story of Otto Bremerman, a closeted gay Navy man who served as an office clerk during the Korean War. He was responsible for typing up the dishonorable discharges of colleagues outed for being gay. Filmmaker Christine Stolakis discovered Bremerman's story in the Oral History Archives at the San Francisco GLBT Historical Society. Stolakis joined KALW's Audrey Dilling in our studios to talk about how she brought an audio story to life on screen.
I knew I wanted to work with a real person's voice, and I ideally wanted to work with something that had already been recorded, because I really like the idea of a discovered history, bringing something to light that otherwise wouldn't have had the same kind of life. Because when I found Otto's interview, it had been transcribed, which is awesome, and it was available to the public, but it was still on cassette tape, actually, so I had to digitize it. So it really had that feeling of discovery that I hope translated to the film.
So all of the visuals in the film, you either shot or used archival?
Yes. Actually, a lot of the archival footage is my family's archival that I found when my uncle passed away. He shared a house with my grandparents, and I went through and helped clean out the house so we could sell it, and found like all this amazing Super 8 footage.
How did working with just the sound limit you, and also what creative opportunities did it open up for you?
So one thing it opened up was that I still don't have a picture of Otto. So I tried to find a picture of him and I never found one. I was immediately drawn to his voice when I heard him speak. I just think he has a really kind of warm but unique speaking voice. So anyway, I loved that I could and anyone else could imagine Otto's face sort of as they wanted to in some ways. I think there's like a personalization you can kind of have with audio where you're really imagining the whole visual world around that person, even because you don't know what they look like. So that was kind of fun because I was able to imagine a whole visual world that to me kind of spoke to the themes of Otto's interview. In terms of what was limiting, I mean, it's like the classic creative problem of the tyranny of too many choices. So I took a lot of time to think through like what I wanted to hone in on, because it's an 8-minute film, but the interview is 3 hours long. So, and it's an oral history. So it covers his life from birth to death, birth to that moment, I should say. He's since passed away. So, and that's the kind of amazing structure of an oral history, which I love too. It's just like, walk me through your life. So I ended up really focusing on just his childhood and then his time in the Navy, because I thought it was really complex and rich. He was in a position that a lot of people can identify with, even if they didn't grow up gay and have the same experiences as him. That idea of being an unintentional middleman, I thought was really cool and interesting, and would translate into something for a really wide audience.
So this is a 60-year-old story.
Yes.
Why do you think it's important that people hear it today?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are two answers. One, it's a real part of our history. I mean, I'll take a step back. I think right now, there's a lot of really great conversations going on about homophobia and transphobia in our current day and time, which is fantastic, and they're important conversations. But as someone who loves history, sometimes I am kind of shocked when I read pretty recent history. This was in the 1950s, where institutionally there is explicit homophobia and transphobia written into the laws of that history. And it's not like it was just collectively a way people were feeling and then treated people poorly. That was actually the law of the military, and continued to be that way until pretty recently in a lot of ways. That to me is interesting. You know, I think it's important to know your history. But then also the way that I try to tell the story is I really see Otto. He came of age in the military. He was in his early 20s and late teens and early 20s when he entered in. It was a way for him to get out of town, where the town that he grew up that where he really couldn't be gay and out and safe. And he like discovered himself and took a lot of interesting risks and came to a lot of interesting conclusions. And I personally really relate to that to someone in my mid-20s. So that I think that process of self-discovery is just like a really fun thing to watch. And I just find that, yeah, really relatable.
So you've made other short films and they cover really diverse topics like the accidental environmentalist in the South and the circus performer.
I'm working on one about Mormon feminists.
So why do you pick these stories and what do they have in common?
The through line, I would say, in my films is that it's about people engaging in their day-to-day lives who are also working on big issues. But I tend to focus a little bit more on the day-to-day because I personally find that a really good reminder that these things are hard and complicated, also doable if you're interested in kind of picking up, if you're interested in a particular issue. But yeah, it's not like, that's not a great answer to your question. I'm still sort of figuring it out.
No, I think it's really interesting that you, like, what, could you talk a little bit more about the day-to-day, like, it seems like there's a way that humanizes people more.
Yeah, yeah. I think in documentary, there's like these different camps of documentary filmmakers. And one of the camps is the quote unquote social issue film. And I've often wondered if I make social issue films because I tend to not make films that are about, for example, homophobia in Otto's case. It, for me, is about a person who was in a really bizarre situation and how he dealt with it. I'm making a film now about Mormon feminists. And it's not so much that and they believe that women should be able to be ordained in the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints. And for me, the film isn't about I want to advocate as well for female ordination. For me, the film is about what does it mean to belong to a faith where you disagree with it. So, yeah, I think there is a humanizing element to it where I'm really interested in just remembering that there are people behind these things and that kind of work is complicated and interesting and dramatic and worth us thinking through, if that makes sense.
That was filmmaker Christine Stolakis. She spoke with KELW's Audrey Dilling. The Typist screens this Sunday at 11 a.m. at the Victoria Theater as part of a program featuring short films by local directors. More information about the Frameline Festival is at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's Audiograph's Julie Kane.
For this week's Audiograph, we've been playing you a sound that I've actually helped make before. Did you figure it out yet? I'm going to give you one more hint. It's the sound hearts would make if they could sing. Let me explain. This was recorded as part of the Garden of Memory experimental music concert, which happens every summer solstice in the most peculiar of places, the Chapel of the Chimes Columbarium in Oakland. It's a historic building designed by the great architect Julia Morgan in the 1920s. It's built sort of like a maze, and it contains thousands of urns with people's remains. During this concert, this place for honoring the deceased comes alive with dozens of experimental musicians and hundreds of visitors from all over the Bay Area. What's it like to be at a gathering of audiophiles in such a unique space? From our archives, KALW's Martina Castro and Seth Samuel bring you this sonic portrait of the Garden of Memory.
It turns out that it all started with a bathroom.
I was writing a story for the East Bay Express about best bathrooms of the East Bay.
That's experimental pianist Sarah Cahill. So about 15 years ago, she wandered into the Columbarium.
I heard some music coming from somewhere in the building, and it was a very, I have to say, sensuous experience wandering around thinking, oh, it's this way, and making a turn and then encountering a little, you know, cage of lovebirds and a little fountain and a pool. And I thought, oh, my God, what is this place?
So that question led to the creation of the Garden of Memory concert. It's kind of an experimental music festival.
And wandering is key to experiencing this festival. We went with a bunch of KLW people, actually, and we lost each other immediately.
We followed some familiar sounds.
And also some that were less familiar.
I don't know how to explain what I just saw.
Now remember, we're not in a concert hall or a conservatory. We're in a columbarium.
David T. Turnbull, 1855 to 1932. Ellen A. Turnbull, 1858 to 1935.
And for the Garden of Memory concert, the Turnbulls are joined by musicians.
Everywhere. But Seth, you know, you and I kept getting separated.
I know, and it was kind of scary.
It was! But at one point we found each other at this installation where sound artist Larnie Fox wasn't playing a traditional instrument.
Yeah, it was like this massive, strange guitar slash music box thing.
Bigger than a person.
Yeah, way, way bigger. There were strings pulled tight across the floor, and a series of motors were spinning feathers at various rates to pluck those strings.
The plucking and the motors turning are what's making this oceanic heartbeat of a sound. Remember when you asked Larnie this question?
What would you say is more important, how it looks or how it sounds?
I don't know. Would you rather be deaf or blind?
Blind.
Yeah, I guess radio people would, huh?
Well, I found his actual answer to be quite interesting.
Let's see, how it looks or how it sounds. What's important is the relationship between the two. For me, this is it's very easy to look at what's happening and see how the sound is generated. And that's not true with a lot of new music. There's a lot of things where there's somebody sitting with a computer. They're creating something live, but you have no idea how it's happening. I really like the materiality of it.
Exploring the relationship of how this all looks and sounds is exactly what Garden of Memory is about. Which brings us to the part of the night where you, Seth, took me to my favorite sound.
Have you been upstairs?
No.
There is something amazing.
Let's go.
Upstairs that I think is going to be... It's going to blow your mind.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
The sound was coming from the top floor atrium where a group of people were in a circle and they were singing. They had their right hands on their hearts and their left hands were on the backs of the people next to them.
It's called the Heart Chant and it's by experimental composer Pauline Oliveros. Members of the Cornelius Cardew Choir based here in the Bay Area were mixed in with regular people who came in and out of the circle without ever breaking the sustained chant. Jed Holtzman, one of the choir members, explained it to me.
Right now there's about 22 people doing the heart chant, and the vast majority of those people just walked up and read the instructions, which are very simple. Basically to think about healing yourself in the world and basically make breath tones, which is to sing any tone on your breath with the syllable ah.
Jed motioned for me to get in the middle of the circle with my big microphone. It was like entering audio recording heaven.
What happens over the course of a couple of minutes is that you start to actually listen with your body.
That's my colleague Casey Miner, who took part in the heart chant for almost 20 minutes.
You're drawing your tune from the people around you, whether that's a harmony or note you're singing in unison, and your breath rises and falls with theirs, and it almost feels like the music swells or falls according to when one person moves in or out of the circle and takes a deep breath and begins singing again. It's very beautiful.
That piece was produced by KALW's Martina Castro and Seth Samuel. Our winner this week is Joshua Raul Brody. Congratulations! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt.
Thanks, Julie. You can also email us at news@kalw.org or catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter @KALW. We love staying in touch with you. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Allison Lee, Timothy Lu Lee, Holly J. McDeed, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Rafi Ronquillo, Raja Shah, Seth Samuel, Lizak Shalat, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producers were Nina Gensler-Debs and Judy Silber. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by the Bernal Hill Players. They've created a sister city musical project featuring two new works from the Bay Area and Mexico. They perform at the Presidio Officers Club tomorrow starting at 5 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.